Call to order this hearing of the Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes, Monday, March 16th. We will delay acting on the minutes. The first bill on our agenda then is Senate File 350, Senator Pappas. Welcome to the committee, Senator Pappas. And do you
Madam
need
Chair, I'm joined here this morning.
Do you need any amendments to your bill at all?
No.
No. Okay, then proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm joined this morning with my my culprit in crime here, Senator Dave Senjum. Just ran some kind of race this weekend, and he'll tell us about it in a minute. Senate File 350 will empower small business employers to offer their employees the opportunity to receive some tax relief for joining and using a fitness facility. Similar to the reimbursement option available to many through their health insurance companies, an employee who joins a fitness facility and uses the facility 8 times a month is eligible to receive a $40 a month subtraction from their adjusted Minnesota taxable income. Many large employers already recognize the need and the benefits of having workplace wellness programs. In Minnesota, about 55% of employers with 100 or more employees now offer some form of health promotion program. According to a 2012 survey, 87% of Minnesota workplaces are interested in improving wellness, but only 23% of employers currently have a worksite wellness initiative. Many of Minnesota's larger employers offer fitness facilities right at their work site, but what about our small businesses? About 50% of our private sector workforce is employed by small businesses, and 97.8% of all Minnesota employers have less than 100 employees. So Senate File 350 is for Minnesota's small business employers and their employees, and it provides a tool by which a small business can offer an incentive for worksite wellness. I have with me this morning, besides Senator Senjum, Mr. Chuck Runyon, the CEO of Anytime Fitness, who will just say a few words.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you. Minnesota has historically...
Sir, you need to identify yourself by name for the record.
Yep, Chuck Runyon, CEO of Anytime Fitness.
Thank you.
Minnesota has historically always had a strong culture of wellness, and we've always been ranked as one of the healthiest states. But the reality is two-thirds of adults in Minnesota are either overweight or obese. And the fact is we're really less unhealthy than the states. And, where we can attack this is through on-site employer wellness, because physical inactivity, or in other words, sitting, has really become the new smoking. And so we need to help people to get active. This benefits both the employer and the employee. And just a few stats I want to share. You know, companies that have a culture of wellness outperform others by 202%, those who don't. Obese adults who are active 3 times a week have annual healthcare cost of $500 less than those who are not active. And then just, 4,000 more steps a day brings down the risk of depression by 50%. So it's not just a physical issue, it's also a mental health issue. So what we're hoping that is Minnesota can be a national leader in worksite wellness and really reclaiming health as an asset to this state, where now it's becoming a liability.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Runyon? Senator Senjum, did you want to speak?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and just maybe just briefly, I just think and have come to know and perhaps better understand my own personal life, the value of trying to get a little healthier, if you will. I see this as an investment in the health of Minnesotans, a positive investment, an opportunity that we might have as a state to encourage wellness. As wellness occurs, so does increased productivity, so does, I think, a more enriched lifestyle. In my own personal life, I will tell you that, I was, a medical mess, probably still am to some degree, but I don't have blood pressure medication anymore. My blood chemistries are much better. In fact, they're normal. Everything about, I think, a healthy life is something positive. And I hope, Madam Chair and members, we can give this a good long look. It maybe is a step out from the standpoint of innovative legislation, but I think it's a positive step out. To the extent we can create a healthier, if you will, Minnesota in healthcare costs, we all know what they are. We talk about them every day, every year. If there's one thing that I know of, I think, that can lend itself to lesser healthcare costs in this state, it is prevention, and wellness is certainly the road to prevention. So, again, I hope that, Madam Chair, you and the committee can give this a long look.
Madam Chair, just to share another personal story, my sister has hypothyroidism, and so it's very difficult for her to lose weight, but she does want to try to stay as healthy as possible, and her health plan does offer her this incentive 8 times a week. So often if I want to meet her for dinner or meet her for an activity, she'll say, well, you know, I have to go to Curves one more time this month in order to get my discount. So I think it is an incentive for workers, if they can get their discount or get some kind of a tax benefit, to keep up the exercise.
May I just add one more thing, Madam Chair?
Mr. Runyon.
It's more than just a Minnesota issue. Of course, this is a national issue as well as a global issue. The World Health Organization has stated recently that physical inactivity is, you know, one of the biggest issues we're facing. And so this is, you know, what we're hoping for is that Minnesota can maybe be a global leader by passing some physical activity legislation to help people get moving, and maybe other states can follow.
So, Senator Pappas, I'm looking at your chart. Do you have that in front of you?
I don't know what they passed out.
This one.
Oh, yeah, I have that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's a current practice for, and I'm stumbling here because I don't know who actually gives the benefit, but is it your health care insurance? Now, not ours, but the health care insurance that subsidizes, like, membership at a Y or something like that, are there programs already where employees enrolled in certain health care plans get a fitness benefit?
Yes, about one-third of Minnesotans are on a program that gives them $20 a month when they use a fitness center 8 times or more. So this would allow now for two-thirds of Minnesotans to be accessible for that. And I know this, but usage is about 3.5 times more on the $20 reimbursement plan than it is when it's not. So fitness incentives do work.
So, Mr. Runyon, this deduction would only be, it's available not, let's see, these deductions would be available to a small business or a business, an owner, an employer who offers the incentive to their employees rather than through their health care plan doing it to promote wellness, right?
That's correct.
So is that what is different here?
Well, most large employers have the resources to put maybe an on-site fitness or a robust wellness plan in place, and they can use pre-tax dollars to do that, and then there's no taxable consequence to the employee.
Yes.
If you're a small to medium-sized business owner, you probably don't have the resources to put an on-site fitness center or do a robust wellness plan. So this encourages them to still provide that to their employees using pre-tax dollars, but also not passing on a taxable burden to the employees. So it kind of levels the playing field with all businesses, regardless of size or where they may be located.
Senator Pappas, how come it's so cheap? If it's doubling.
I haven't seen the fiscal note.
It's a revenue estimate, and for FY 2016, it's $900,000, and 2017, it's $1 million. I'm just curious about why it wouldn't be a greater cost. I don't know.
Madam Chair, I can only guess that.
I'm going to. Ms. Pollack has some explanation for the revenue estimate. Ms. Pollack?
Madam Chair and members, Ms. McQuay can perhaps comment on this a little further, but as the revenue estimate notes, this subtraction is available to the extent that the benefit is included as wages in taxable income. So employers that are providing on-site fitness facilities, that benefit is not considered wages. Employers that pay for off-site fitness facility use, generally that is considered wages, and therefore the employer is able to deduct that as the total amount of wages for employees. So the bulk of the cost comes from the in the latter case where employers pay employers are including fitness off-site fitness facility use as wages. The bulk of the cost comes from the employees now being able to take that amount as a subtraction, where under current law they don't.
So it's the employee that gets the subtraction from their federal income, not the small business. I still don't understand how it works. Sorry,
Madam Chair, it could be both.
Could be both. Okay.
Yes.
All right. That's
Madam
helpful.
Chair,
Ms. McQuay.
I'll just add. So from the pool that Ms. Pollack pointed out, then that is so it's all the employer or all the employees, and then that's reduced because in the bullet number 3, the revenue estimate assumes that 34% of private sector employees have access. And then that pool is further reduced because public sector employees don't have access. And then that is further reduced for the 9-month requirement or 9-month average that people tend to go, and then the requirement of 8 times per month. So from the entire set of employees, then that's reduced.
Senator Skoy, thank you, Ms. McQuay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. McQuay, just so I understand, so they're getting about $40 a month benefit. And there's 12 months a year, so that's $480. And if it's an 8% tax rate, that's $32. Is that the way I read that?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, that's correct. But they do have to, they would only get it for the months that they go 8 times a month. And then, yeah. So, yes, Senator Skoy.
And Madam Chair and
Senator
members,
Pappas.
We wanted to make sure people go, which is
absolutely
why we have the requirement,
sure.
And also we capped it to keep the cost down.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Pappas, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not.
Anybody else want to comment on Senate File 350?
I just looked at this and figured, well, it's 8.
Seeing none, Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 350 be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Sengem. We need a vote on that motion. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The next bill on our agenda. Keep going. We do have a quorum, so we'll go back to item number 1. Are there any corrections to the minutes from March 11th?
I'd move that.
Senator Skoy moves approval of the minutes from March 11th. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Say no. The motion prevails and the minutes stand approved. The next bill is Senate File 531, Senator Sharon. Senator Sharon, is the bill in the shape you wanted, or do you need an amendment?
No amendments, Madam
okay.
Chair.
Then you may proceed.
Thank you, members of the Tax Committee and Madam Chair, for giving some time to Senate File 531. I can tell you I have a memory sitting here of what it was like to be a freshman legislator trying to present a bill, and I have that same feeling now of inner anxiety. It may not show on the outside, but I'm in a committee where I'm really over my head. I'm really over my head. But I will talk to you about what I'm trying to accomplish, and
sure.
And I'm hoping that you will make sure the language actually accomplishes that before you decide whether
Senator
or not
Sharon,
to support
if you
me.
Explain the purpose, we'll have we'll have counsel do the technical explanation.
Thank you very much. If you are an employer in the food and beverage industry, you are entitled to a credit for the Social Security and Medicare taxes that you pay on your employees' tipped income. To qualify, you have employees who receive tips, and you paid or incurred employer Social Security and Medicare taxes on these tips. It is not applied to other tipped employees other than those in the food and beverage industry at the federal level. No credit is given for tips used to meet the federal minimum wage, which is done under a tip credit in other states. All employers are required to report tips who report this as income and withhold FICA taxes. I cannot explain why the federal government gave a credit to the food and beverage industry for the taxes that they paid on those tips for Social Security and Medicare, and why they did not include other tipped employees. But that's the situation that we are in. So what this bill would do is relate only to those employers with tipped employees who do not benefit from these federal tax credits. In this bill, the credit provides for employers who pay payroll taxes for tipped employees, and they will receive a tax break, a credit that reduces the final total amount of a tax, a reduction after income is applied to the tax rate. Using the credit will make it in line, using a credit as an approach to this will make it in line with how Minnesota treats taxes paid to other states or other governments. It relates better to the federal tax credit and is easy for the departments in the state to scale. The credit in this bill is non-refundable, so if no taxes are due, they would not receive the credit. So in terms of the bill itself, the first provision in the bill allows a credit for Minnesota employers in the amount of excess Social Security Medicare taxes paid. The excess amount is defined as the taxes paid on the difference between Minnesota's minimum wage and the total wage, including tips. And in subdivision two, it limits the credit to those not eligible for the federal credit and excludes amounts used to claim the credit from any amount deducted for the purposes of calculating federal taxable income. It requires that the credit is non-refundable and requires that for unitary groups and corporations that are partners in a partnership, if the credit exceeds the tax liability for one member of the group, the credit must be allocated to another member of that group. And it provides the credits allowed for partnerships, LLCs, taxed as partnerships or S corporations are allocated to partners, members, and shareholders on a pro rata basis. That is, in essence, what the bill is and what it does.
Senator Sharon, I think you did a fine job. What you're asking for is to extend the credit that's available at the federal level, and it's a federal law that it's only food and beverage, not a state law, those industry sectors that have tipped employees that are currently not eligible for the federal credit. I just wonder how, you know, the casual tip in what is not usually a tipped service, how are they going to know that?
How will I know? Would you say
I'm trying to think of, some sort of casual occupation or something where it's not food or beverage, where somebody just does something for you and you pay them and then you give them something extra. They have to be an employee. Is that, I mean,
yes, it has to be. It has to be reported. There has to have been a tax paid.
And the employee has to do the reporting.
They have to be reporting the tips and they have to be paying these taxes on those tips in order to even be eligible for this. So anything that's occurring that's off the books or under the table or not recorded, we aren't able to touch that.
The cash economy is hard to unearth. Are there comments or questions for Senator Sharon? It's a $12 million hit.
It's a what?
$12 million hit on the general fund for the for this biennium. Oh, you don't have the revenue estimate? I am sorry. Somebody delivering it to her? Ms. Pollack, do we put those revenue estimates over there?
Madam Chair, I believe so.
Okay.
Yes.
So I might encourage others that have bills to, if you haven't seen the revenue estimate on your bill, if you'd go and check over there. And when you come to the witness table, tell us, because we want you to have as much information as in our packets to deal with the bill. But you explained it exactly the way the revenue estimate follows along. But it's not a huge amount, you know. It's not $50 million, but it's certainly not it's not insignificant to allow that. Do you have any comment on the revenue estimate or any further comment? And then I'll ask members if they have questions for you, Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Riss. Thank you for this. This is the first that I have seen this, but I think anything over $150 is a lot of money. So in my checkbook, I'm in big trouble here. Accepting that, I just would want to talk about this in relationship to the small businesses and some other businesses that struggle with very fine margins in some of their businesses, and often come to us to talk about another approach that they would like to see, which is the tip credit. And of course, there's a great concern about changes in utilizing the tip credit to calculate wage to a certain level, causing a downward pressure on those wages. Mm-hmm. So because that really has not been able to get off the dime, and we haven't found another way to be responsive to the concerns of those businesses, I thought that at a minimum what we might consider doing is what I've put in front of you, that these other very small businesses might have the opportunity to experience the same benefit that the federal government is giving to the food and beverage industry. And it has to do with underlying belief that I have, and I think many share, and that is that what I pay a person as a tip is income to the employee, but as a business owner, I'm not paying that as a wage. But I am treated as a business as if it is a wage and asked to pay taxes on it. So I think that we have to get clear about that. Either it is a wage that I am paying as an employer or it isn't. And right now it isn't. It is a tip that's paid from an individual to an employer. It's an income employee. It's an income for the employee upon which they ought to be paying taxes. But the question is, should the business be paying the taxes on that?
And Senator Sharon, on that income that's reported, it's all above board, it's being reported, the tip income is being reported, does the employer currently withhold the due withholding of income tax and Social Security and Medicare on those tips, as well as paying their own share of the Social Security tax? Do you know?
For the employee?
Yes.
I believe they do, but I would ask somebody who is more informed than I am.
Ms. Pollack, do they need to, once the tip income is reported, do they both pay the employer's share as well as the withhold the employee's share?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay.
Yes, on both.
Okay. All right. So that question is answered. Is there any other? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sharon, it's interesting. I have a number of things that I'm kind of rolling around trying to figure out. But I think the thing that I'd like to have your response on most is, if the federal government was treating these employees the same as they were their restaurant employees, you wouldn't be sitting in front of us today. So it's primarily a federal issue, and what you're asking us to contemplate is, as a state, paying for these costs that could be construed as primarily a federal responsibility. And what's your reaction to that?
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Est. Yes, what you're saying is true, that if for some reason, which I cannot explain, the federal government did not, probably in the same way that we do sometimes, we take a look at the cost of something and then we roll it back a little bit in order to accommodate to a budgetary constraint. But for some reason did not include other tipped employees, which I don't think is a reasonable action. And the federal government ought to have expanded this to include all tipped employees. Because if it's okay for food and beverage, it's good for all tipped employees. But they didn't. So then the underlying question I think you're asking me is, why should the state then engage in making up for what the federal government ought to have done? And, you know, that's a little tougher hill to climb, accepting that the federal government has retreated consistently from a number of what I believe are its obligations. One other area that I see often in my area of the world, which is health, human services, and housing, is the consistent and continual retreat from supporting affordable housing. And we have consistently had to partner with them in terms of trying to make that whole. So the question is whether or not, again, the state wants to step forward and make this situation whole, fully understanding that our preference would be that the federal government would have resolved this issue at the federal level.
Thank you.
Anything further for Senator Sharon? Thank you very much, Senator Sharon. Senator Eaton moves that Senate file 531 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you
very much,
Senator Sharon. Next, we are going to have a report on residency, and then we will move to consider two bills on residency, Senate File 745 and Senate File 1222. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner, and congratulations on your confirmation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cynthia Bowerly. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. Thanks to all of you last Thursday, I am honored by the Senate's confirmation. So thank you very much. And I'm pleased to be with you this morning to share with you just a brief overview of a report the department recently completed on the issue of residency. As a result of the discussions during the 2014 legislative session, the department has initiated a review of the residency law, both the statute and the rule, with the great help of a group of stakeholders, many of whom you will hear from today. We know this is an important issue and that there will be a great deal of conversation, and we hope that this report provides you with a baseline of information about the department's process, about the rule, and about particularly in comparison to other states. The report includes information about the department's listening sessions with tax professionals, the history of residency, how the department approaches residency audits and appeals, how other states determine residency, and the department's next steps in the residency process going forward, which, of course, includes working with this committee and members who are interested in this issue. We held a number of listening sessions throughout the intervening time between the last legislative session and today, and finished those meetings up in the first quarter of this year. We appreciate greatly the help of the many stakeholder groups who participated with us, and those included over 100 tax professionals, including members of the Minnesota Society of Certified Public Accountants, the Chamber of Commerce, the State Bar Association, the Association of Public Accountants, and the Bankers Association. Their input and feedback was greatly beneficial to the department, and their feedback is contained in the report. The themes that came out of those listening sessions fell into two general areas: administrative and procedural feedback, things about the audit process, documentation, training, communication, and educational materials, and also feedback about the policy, about modernizing the factors used to determine residency and clarifying those definitions. The department recognized during this process that much of this information was based on personal interactions and experiences, which resulted in different feedback from different individuals who attended the listening sessions. For example, one participant may prefer Minnesota to approach these issues as another state does, or implement a point system. Often New York was referenced as a state to look to. Others participants urged the department not to go in that direction, and so to accommodate these varied viewpoints and preferences, the report tries to focus on common themes as opposed to particular solutions. And again, we know that this is an issue that will be of great conversation, and we look forward to working with you on that. As you know, residency is defined in Minnesota Statute 2901 and Minnesota Rule 8001-300. Those are, of course, found in the appendix. We also hope that the report will be a resource for you in terms of compiling all of the information about residency in one place as we have these conversations about Minnesota law. Minnesota Supreme Court, of course, has issued important decisions on residency and domicile, starting as early as 1953 in Miller, again in Larson. And I think the Maurer case, which was issued in 2013, was an important starting point for the most recent conversations around residency. Larson and Maurer, and particularly in Maurer, where the court found that an NBA basketball referee failed to prove he'd established domicile in Florida after buying a townhome, registering to vote, and registering a vehicle there. The court noted that Maurer spent far more time in Minnesota and continued to maintain a home and most of his financial accounts in Minnesota. One of the things that became clear as we spoke with stakeholders throughout the last several months was that many professionals in Minnesota are noticing that other professionals in other states are using the Maurer case as a marketing tool against Minnesota professionals. And that is, I think, certainly, I would suggest, was probably not the intent of the court when it issued that decision, and certainly something that we share a concern about. As you know, there are a number of factors that are used, and certainly one factor like where the location of your professional services representative is not the only factor that would ever be considered. So we understand the importance of ensuring that Minnesota professionals are not being treated unfairly by competitors in other states. And so as I move through the final part of the presentation on the report, we will describe to you some of the efforts that we think the department can take to help resolve that issue in particular. The report includes a breakdown of how other states determine residency and domicile. For example, 33 states, including Minnesota, use a set of factors. 44 states do not limit the factors that can be considered to determine domicile. 11 states have an agreement to look at domicile factors similarly, and those are mostly in the Northeast. And 36 states consider the number of days a person spends in the state. And 18 states use the same number of days, 183 count, in their consideration. As a result of this process, the department learned valuable information. And as a result of that, we are already starting to make changes to how our process works for residency. We heard important feedback about how taxpayers and their professional preparers understand our information. So we are reviewing and updating some of our documentation of our process, including the contact letter and request for information. We will simplify the format, reduce the amount of information we initially request, and include a set of common questions and answers taxpayers have had about the audit process. We will streamline our questionnaire to collect information in the most efficient manner, and we will eliminate questions that we can answer through our research. We will modify our procedures and our training to ensure that we have common standard approaches to requesting and reviewing information. And we will revise our audit reports to more closely reflect the intent component of domicile. So those are the tasks that we have undertaken already to start streamlining the audit process. In addition, we think it's very important that we have public information that is clear so taxpayers and professionals can understand as readily as they can about the current state of residency under the current law. And through that, we will be providing taxpayers and representatives with helpful tips for handling residency cases. We will be updating all of our website content and centralizing it into a one-stop shop for residency information. We will issue a revenue notice based on current law and a rule that clearly states that the mere physical location of an attorney or CPA providing services is not a factor in determining residency. In addition, we understand there's a lot of interest in the issue of financial institutions. And given modern technology and online banking, one does not actually ever need to set foot into a branch any longer. And so the location of a bank account is not effective when determining residency as opposed to things like transactions. We will update our existing fact sheets and other materials to include modernized explanations, particularly based on, again, how technology has changed. For example, factor Y, the location of schools that children attend and tuition status to help determine resident or non-resident status. We will also consider how students attend school because online school may be the choice for that family. Again, we will look at transactions with financial institutions rather than the location of the bank account. We think that by taking these steps, we can help implement some of what we heard in the feedback from the listening sessions and make the residency process more clear under current law. We also appreciate that this committee and the one in the House has a great deal of interest in this, and we look forward to working with you. There are two bills already that you're hearing today. We look forward to working with you on those, and in the meantime, we do want to be able to provide taxpayers with as clear of information as we can about the process and current law. So we wouldn't necessarily want to wait if there's improvements that we can make right now. So we understand this is the beginning of the conversation. I again want to thank the legislature for this opportunity to complete this report. I want to thank the stakeholders, many of whom you'll hear from today. The series of meetings that we had with them was very beneficial to the department. And we hope that you will find the report helpful to this consideration about Minnesota's current law, about how other states approach residency. And we appreciate the opportunity to take this thorough review and look at our process to improve it as much as we can. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. We certainly appreciate the report and the steps that you're taking already to address concerns. There are some of us, however, that want to change the law, too. And I think it really bears a lot of scrutiny. As you know, the two more recent Supreme Court cases were not unanimous, and Justice Anderson calls the whole area the domicile swamp. And, we're trying to wade through that in a responsible way for the legislature. So appreciate the what you're doing. I do have hesitation of just thinking that issuing an additional revenue notice addresses all the issues. So that's nice, but I'm not comfortable with that being a final action to seek resolution for the concerns that have been raised by the various professionals that are at least are addressed in Senate File 745. But we do appreciate the report, and in particular, the way and the process by which you even make a determination from audit leads whether someone's return qualifies for further action by the department to make sure that Minnesota is getting the taxes that are due it. And I wasn't aware exactly how that worked in the department, so that was useful information, and I appreciate your including that in the report. Are there other questions here for Commissioner Bowerly? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know exactly when we're going to have this the conversation. Are there bills coming up with regard to changes? But I'm looking at the report in the Minnesota to New York comparison. And I'm just trying
to... Could you reference the page number?
It's on page 9. And then also I'm looking at on page 6, there's items that 11 states in Washington, D.C. have. Home, time, items near and dear, family connections, et cetera. It looks to me like that group of states is also including the CPA attorney and other business services in their calculation. Am I reading this report right?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, I'm checking in with the other staff here, and yes, that is correct. And as you'll note in the report, when we did look at New York in particular, many of those cases would have actually gone the other way, at least of the recent cases in Minnesota. So I think that is one of the challenges, is that these are individual sets of fact patterns with individual taxpayers. And so this looking to one state's alternative might result in differing answers for those different taxpayers.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, so that being said, but I'm looking at the graphs with the number of states that have differing factors, et cetera. Do you think there would be some value being included in with a larger group so there would be more consistency in this, you know, across the country, as opposed to having our own separate different from most people? It looks to me like we're in with four other states that do things comparable.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Bowering?
That certainly, Chair Rest and Senator Skoy, I think that if the legislature wanted to look to some consistency, there are some models out there. As you know, the Northeast states have some similar set of factors that they have all sort of agreed upon. We could certainly offer some additional comparison, particularly of regional other states in the region, if that would be of interest. We'd certainly be able to provide you with additional detail on that if that would be of interest.
And Madam Chair, I don't want to presume anything, but it looks to me like with the legislation that's being, you know, going to be contemplated, that this conversation is going to go on for a little while this session. Senator Rest has a bill here, and Senator Miller, and I'm not exactly sure which one is which there, but I assume Senator Rest has a bill on this, and so we're going to have some conversations.
We're taking my bill and Senator Ortman's bill up.
Senator Ortman,
right now.
And you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
As soon as questions or comments for Commissioner Bowerly are completed.
And Senator Skoy. Sorry, Madam Chair. Just so that as this conversation is ongoing, if you have input into it, I certainly would encourage you to be part of that conversation. And I think Senator Gazelka has interest in this too.
Absolutely.
So, thank you, Senator Skoy, and thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. I appreciate the work that the department did on this in this area. We do have two bills that address issues of residency and has become our custom on bills that deal with the same subject matter. Senator Ortman will go to the witness table and present both of them, and then take testimony. And whoever comes forward can comment on either or both or whatever. Is that agreeable?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay. So the next two bills will be heard together, Senate File 745 and 1222.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, let's start with Senate File 745 and then Then we'll do Senator Arvin 7-12-22 later. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what we'll do so that if it's agreeable, since so that both Senator Ortman and I can participate in the discussion, that once we present our bills, we'll return to the table there and then hear from the witnesses. Okay.
Very good.
So with regard to Senate File 745, I have the A2 amendment.
First stop, Senator,
yes.
Senator Rest has an author's amendment, the A2. It's in your packet, members. Any conversation? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and members, what Senate File 745 does is to challenge and then prohibit two elements of the determination of residency for the purposes of income and estate taxes. First is the location of an individual's attorney or accountant or financial advisor. And secondly, and these are broad categories, there's much more specific language in the text of the bill itself. And then secondly, the place of business of a financial institution at which the individual applies for any new type of credit or opens or maintains any type of account. We did hear from the department that they do not consider just where someone has a bank account as a determinant factor. But I think we need to make that clearer, and I believe that the amendment does that. It did change the language on page 2 to not just referencing Minnesota in terms of where an individual is domiciled, but just generally. So it's not just in Minnesota. And then there are it's important other than the clarifying language that is included on lines 1-4 and 1-5 of the amendment. The rest of the amendment is simply changing the effective date from the day after enactment to making it a calendar year effectiveness. So it's effective for the calendar year 2015. Just for the ease of the taxpayer and the department, that there's a clear understanding of when this would come to bear. So that is the summary of 745 to remove those factors, and in addition to the report made by the, I don't know if you have this, report made by the department. I also happen to be a member of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence, which was the old Minnesota Taxpayers Association, not the Minnesota Taxpayers League, but the Taxpayers Association. And I became a member in the early 80s before they ruled that legislators couldn't belong. And so I got grandfathered in, and I think I am the only sitting legislator that is a member of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. However, in the addition of their newsletter, January-February 2015, number one, they have an article by Gina Ciola, who is a director of PwC Minneapolis, providing a practitioner's perspective on the complexity of Minnesota's residency setting, and in their newsletter. And I certainly would be willing to share that. It's a very extensive letter, article, and does indeed analyze the arguments in both Miller and in the Maurer case. So if anybody's interested in getting into the weeds on that, I'm happy to share it with them.
And before we go to Senator Ortman, Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chair. And Senator Ress, thank you for bringing this forward and you and I working on this.
Yes.
And I just want to say as we're moving forward here, it really isn't about the person that's left. It's about protecting the businesses that are in Minnesota.
Yes.
And that's what we're doing here. And I want to say, you know, I was frustrated with Minnesota Revenue through the interim. But since then, I would say I appreciate the fact that they have been very active. Communicating with me, Mr. Cummings has regularly done that, and I feel like we're going to get a good product as we're moving forward. But I wanted to thank you for taking the lead on this as well, and Senator Ortman. I think at the end of the day, we're going to have things that are going to help the folks here, and that's what, to me, that's what this is about.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, I think you hit the nail on the head. It really is about making sure that these issues of domicile and determining residency are not going to hurt people that choose to engage attorneys or CPAs or financial advisors in the state of Minnesota. We would, on the contrary, would like to reinforce those choices and support those businesses.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, that's my presentation.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Senator Rest on her bill. I appreciate what that bill attempts to do as well regarding an issue that I think we have a great responsibility to address, which is the fact that the Department of Revenue has created a very difficult atmosphere for Minnesota taxpayers that spend some significant amount of their time in the state or out of the state. The Senate File 1222 hopefully brings out into the open a conversation that we should have about defining residency for purposes of taxation in the state of Minnesota, and addresses it in two ways. The first is to suggest that as an alternative proposal for beginning the conversation, we allow Minnesota taxpayers to file an affidavit to state that they are or are not a resident of the state for tax purposes. An affirmative statement from them should begin the conversation, as opposed to what looks like an inquiry and an investigation into taxpayers that spend significant amounts of time either in or out of the state. And I have every confidence in saying I'm sure everyone on this committee has been contacted by taxpayers frustrated with the fact that the Department of Revenue is asking for every gas receipt, every flight travel plan, every aspect of their lives in order to determine their domicile and their residency for tax purposes. I don't think that's a good conversation the way it's being conducted. I think that they would acknowledge that there are some adjustments that need to be made. So I think we should begin with a statement, an affirmative statement from our taxpayers about what their intent is and how they spend their time. And going from there, then the Department of Revenue can review and decide whether that is an accurate statement or not. The second relates to our economy specifically. Minnesota has an awful lot of visitors that come here to take advantage of high-end medical services that we have here in Rochester at the University of Minnesota and seek medical treatment here. And we want to make sure that there is no disadvantage to that economy and that industry, and also to these folks that come to the state for purposes of seeking medical treatment. And so the second part of Senate File 1222 addresses that. I know that the Department of Revenue wants to have a constructive conversation with us. I know that's what I want here, too. These are ideas to put on the table to say, I think we all know there need to be some reforms, and these are reforms that should be considered by this committee. And I know we have quite a few testifiers that will be here to talk about some of the concerns that they have with the way the state has been and the department has been applying these tests of residency for purposes of taxation. Thank you, members.
Questions for Senator Ortman, Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if it would be just more expedient if we went ahead and laid these bills over and then took the testimony on them. And mine has to be laid over as amended.
Sure. So Senator Restow,
I would move that Senate File 745 be, as amended, be laid over for further consideration for the omnibus tax bill.
Senator Rest moves Senate File 45 be laid over, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. All those in favor? 745.
Aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. 745 as amended is laid over. Senator Gazelka moves, or Senator Ortman moves, Senate File 1222 be laid over for possible inclusion. Questions, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And yes, we'll go to testifiers now, and Senator Ortman, Senator Rust come back to the table. Gino, Mr. Fragnito, and Mr. Nelson. We probably have room for three. Mr. Witt.
Welcome to the division, Mr. Fragnito. If you would like to begin, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Gino Fragnito, the Government Relations Director at the Minnesota CPA Society, and part of a larger group of businesses and associations that have been working on this residency issue for a couple years now. And I'd like to thank you, Senator Rest, and the other co-sponsors for bringing forth Senate File 745, and also thank the department for working with us over the interim to address the situation and the issues that are addressed in these bills. But I do want to say that this bill is not here because of any action by the Department of Revenue, but we believe necessary because of two Supreme Court decisions that have cited the hiring of Minnesota professionals and are now being used to market against those professionals, particularly harming small businesses here in Minnesota who may not have the option to have offices located in other states. We have worked and met with the department several times, either individually or collectively, and have talked about and addressed the concerns, but the opinion of the tax lawyers has concluded that changing the law is really the only effective way to overrule the Supreme Court decisions and address the issue facing us today. Some of the groups that have been involved in the discussions include the Minnesota CPA Society, the Minnesota Bar Association, the Bankers Association, Insurance and Financial Services Council, the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents Association, National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors of Minnesota, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Minnesota Business Partnership, and the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. And representatives from all those organizations are here today also if there are questions. So in closing, as Commissioner Bowerly said, professionals in other states are using the 2013 Maurer and Larson cases as marketing tools, sometimes resorting to scare tactics against Minnesota-based professionals. I don't believe, and I don't think others believe, that our laws should discriminate against hiring Minnesota-based professionals, and this bill will help correct that problem. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fragnito. And I had referred to a Miller case, but I really meant the Larson case that you just mentioned. Any questions for Mr. Fragnito or comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. Just one brief question. We changed the effective date to after December 31st, 2014. As an accountant, I would think that that would be better than what it was in the original bill.
Well, I think any time,
Mr. Fragnito.
Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, I think that an effective date in the middle of a tax year does make it problematic, and having it start at the beginning makes it the treatment of it all taxpayers equal, so you don't have some who in a particular year might be impacted and others may not.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Fragnito, and anybody else who wishes to comment on this. You know, I asked the commissioner about whether there would be some benefit being in with a larger group of states. Seems to me it would be harder to market against Minnesota if there was 20 other states doing it the same way, same policies on this area. Do you have any thought on that, or I mean, it appears like Minnesota's kind of got its own little plan going here, being an outlier.
Mr. Fragnito.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I think if you look at the domicile factors holistically, there are some models out there that Minnesota certainly could look to. I think on this particular issue, we are kind of in a unique situation, and I'm not aware of other states where there are Supreme Court cases that are being used against professionals in those states. There may be, but I'm not aware of them.
Next, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Okay, I'm Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Scott Nelson. I'm an attorney with Helmuth & Johnson. I'm also licensed as a CPA, so I get to testify today on behalf of both organizations. I'm going to be addressing Senate File 745 in particular. I just wanted to comment on the last question. One of the benefits of having consistency among the states is to avoid conflicts of law issues. I deal with that in other areas, and I'm a trust and estate lawyer primarily, but we deal with conflicts of law issues all the time. And in this particular case, you could literally have situations where two states are claiming under their criteria that the same person is a resident in both states, and then we have to resolve it through conflicts of laws, which basically are driven by federal constitutional issues among the states. And I could see where, having a consortium of states that have consistency across state lines would be very helpful for taxpayers in general. But getting back to my testimony on Senate File 745, I know some of this has already been covered, but I just want to restate briefly again that I appreciate the Department of Revenue's efforts in this area. I was able to read the report that came out on Friday, and I appreciate all the time and effort that they put into that. I was involved with the listening sessions, both for the CPAs and the Bar Association, when they came and visited. And again, we really appreciate them making that outreach and listening to our concerns. As we've mentioned, the Larson and Maurer cases are our primary issue with the Senate File 745 and the reasons for us to bring that forward. Excuse me. And I'll read from that very briefly so that you can get the exact language that was used by the Supreme Court and why we believe that legislation is needed to fix this issue and not a revenue notice alone from the Department of Revenue. The revenue factors that they use for determining residency, there's 26. Factor T, which has been mentioned, basically says that one of the factors is the location of business relationships and the place where the businesses are located. And we're addressing that issue in this Senate File 745. Again, the Department of Revenue study is great. We appreciate all the work that they've put into that. But as a professional, again, speaking as an attorney and a CPA, our biggest concern right now is that we now have common law that's been established by our Supreme Court, which needs to be overruled by legislation and not by an executive order from the executive branch. We need the legislative branch to basically counter what the judicial branch has given us in these 2013 cases, again being the Maurer and Larson cases. So we are looking for legislation to correct the common law that we now have in Minnesota. And I'm just going to quote a couple of sentences from each case. The first is the Larson case, which again was a 2013 Supreme Court case dealing with the residency issue. And in the factors, in its conclusion, the court literally says this: Larson used one attorney in Nevada during the tax years, but retained four law firms in Minnesota during the same period. And Larson employed two accounting firms in Minnesota and maintained a brokerage account in Minnesota. And that's it. There's no mention about when the taxpayers were actually here interacting with those professionals. Why did they have those professionals in the Larson case in particular? He was a non-resident, or he claimed to be a non-resident, but he actually still had some active business interests here, and obviously he needed Minnesota lawyers to handle the business transactions that occurred for those Minnesota-based businesses. But again, just the fact that the law firms or the CPAs were here did not necessarily mean that it was more likely that he was a resident of Minnesota. And again, we want to make sure that the language used by the Supreme Court goes well beyond where the location of the professionals is. And then again, in the Maurer case, which again was the NBA professional and determining whether he was a resident of Florida or Minnesota, the court simply says, the court found that Mauer used the services of five professionals in Minnesota and two in Florida. We conclude that given the greater number of professional relationships in Minnesota, there was sufficient support for the tax court to find that it favors a Minnesota domicile. So again, no discussion about any interaction with the taxpayer. It was just simply that he had more professionals in Minnesota than he had in Florida. So therefore, he's more likely to be a Minnesota resident. So again, this is the issue that we're addressing in Senate File 745. Basically, we have a common law that's been established by the judicial branch that says the location of the professional is what determines the factor in whether a person might be a resident. And what Senate File 745 is intended to do is to say, no, it's not the location of the professional. It's the actual interaction with the taxpayer, you know, the actual days that they're in Minnesota meeting with their lawyer or CPA, not the fact that they've retained somebody. By analogy, I would also, you know, just mention for those of you that are, you know, either have moved in and out of a state or know of people that have moved in or out of a state, you know, you might be familiar with, you know, they've moved from Chicago and maybe they had a financial advisor or a life insurance agent that they worked with there for 20 years. They, in many cases, will retain those professionals even though they've moved to another state. And this is really no different. If somebody's worked with Minnesota professionals and decides to become a resident of another state, they should not be penalized for the fact that they continue to retain those professional relationships. The other major issue that I think has been touched on by the prior testimony this morning is, again, the fact that this issue actually probably impacts the smaller CPA and attorney firms that are in each of your districts more than it does the large firms because, you know, quite frankly, a lot of the large firms have offices in different states. So those clients can simply say, well, I'm going to start working with your attorney in Florida or Arizona or, you know, wherever the other offices are located, and, you know, I'll continue to work with your firm, but I'm just not going to do your business in Minnesota. On the other hand, if we have the smaller professional firms who have no satellite offices, they basically just lose the business altogether. And as Gino mentioned, we have found websites, particularly in Florida, and in my site in the trust and estates area, we found attorneys who have actually listed this issue and said, you know, move your professional work to your attorneys in Florida if you claim to be a Florida resident so that Minnesota doesn't try to bring you back in as a Minnesota resident for tax purposes. So we have uncovered some of those websites in our investigations. The bottom line for me and my testimony, again, is that we basically do have common law that goes beyond what the Department of Revenue is able to fix at this point in time, and we would like to seek legislation that would clarify that issue for our professionals here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nelson. Next, please, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair, my name is Joe Witt. I'm President and CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association.
Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I won't repeat all the testimony that's been said, but the banking issue is slightly different, so I appreciate the opportunity to testify here today. We've been working with the department. We've been working with this larger working group on this issue for, again, a couple years like all the rest of the folks. Bottom line for us is the location of your banking relationship, where you hold your accounts, we don't believe it is a good indicator of residency, given the fact that you can bank from anywhere these days. Telephone banking, internet banking, mobile banking, direct deposits, ATM access. With all these modern conveniences, you truly can bank from anywhere in the world. The issue we hear about from our local member banks here in the state of Minnesota is people being encouraged to terminate their banking relationships here in Minnesota. These are good long-term relationships that have been established, and we are hoping that through this bill, the location of the bank accounts will no longer be considered as part of the analysis on residency, again, because it's not really a good indicator of where your residency should be where you should be considered a resident. So we're asking you to please support your local banks and support this bill, Senate File 745. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Witt. Are there any comments from Mr. Witt? Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Witt, does the same hold true for the banks as I heard on some of the other service firms where, like, U.S. Bank would be nationwide and would have less of an impact where my community bank from Thief River Falls wouldn't? Is that the same? I mean, how do they determine residency at U.S. Bank?
Mr. Witt.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, I think it would be a little bit, I don't know exactly how the department or a court would look at one of those larger banks as far as if they would look at the individual branches or how that would work out. But you can imagine that, you know, certainly the smaller banks would be, depending on how the courts and how the revenue department would analyze it, you could see a more significant impact there. But I think the issue is the same when it boils down. It's whether or not the location of the bank is an indicator of residence, I think, is the basic bottom line question. We understand that where you're originating transactions will still be considered, and that's absolutely fine. If you say you're in Minnesota on a certain day and you're originating transactions from outside the state or vice versa, we can understand how that would be a factor. But the mere location of the bank itself, I don't think, is a good indicator of the residency status.
Anything further for these gentlemen? Then we have Dominic Sposato, Ms. Cadoon, and then after we hear that testimony, we'll hear from Mr. Cummings and the department to comment on both bills, if you would. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Sposato, you want to go first, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dominic Sposato, I'm here representing the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors.
Could you bring the microphone closer
as well as
and
the,
talk louder? Thank you. The acoustics are not very good in
I
here.
I understand.
Oh. That's better. Yeah.
I also represent the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents. And as financial advisors and independent agents, we'd like to thank, first of all, Senator Rest and Senator Gazalka for calling this issue to our attention last year during the discussions in conference committee. We went back to our membership and discussed this and found out that this really is a growing problem related to financial advisors in Minnesota. Financial advisors, most of them are very small business people here in Minnesota in your districts, build very trusted relationships with their clients over the years, and it's a very personal relationship built on trust. Now we're finding that our financial advisors are being told by their clients that have moved out of state or even in Florida, Arizona, somewhere vacationing and staying there a few months, that they have to be considerate of where their financial services are. And they're being told to drop them. And in fact, we have seen seminars that are created, particularly in Florida, where Minnesotans are targeted and brought into seminars, and they're told various things related to this legislation and the issues, particularly related to their financial advice. We think this is very problematic, especially for seniors who can be vulnerable and are being encouraged to drop their trusted advisors and seek relationships from primarily strangers, and we think that's a problem. So we're very supportive of the legislation going forward, and we encourage your support, and thank you very much for bringing this issue to our attention.
Thank you, Mr. Sposato. You know, we think the people that using financial advisors, that it's the client who's out of state and the financial advisor is here, and they come here to confer. But it's also the case that some financial advisors who are Minnesota themselves, Minnesota residents, have their business here, have clients in other states that they go and visit. So that person does not come to Minnesota. I know of one person who makes a couple of trips a year to you know, wealthier clients to bring them up to date or whatever, making suggestions for investments and so on. And they go to California, they go to Nevada, they go to Arizona. and probably Florida as well to meet with those clients. So those clients don't come here, but the advisor is here. And I don't know how the department actually deals with that in determining a residency factor if it's the Minnesota financial advisor that goes to Florida or California or Nevada or Arizona to meet with their clients there in terms of fulfilling their duties and obligations to them. Mr.
Madam
Spizzetto.
Chairman, if I could address that. Insurance agents can be licensed in many states. And many agents who, from Minnesota, have clients in Florida and Arizona and other some of the warm states, and they are also licensed in those states to sell insurance. So I think the issue related to us is where is the location, the office of that particular financial advisors. And mm-hmm. since they're licensed here in Minnesota as resident agents, they would be considered to be from Minnesota, even if they're going to Arizona, Florida, or somewhere else. And providing insurance services. So I think I don't really know how the department would address that. My assumption is that they would base it on the residency of the insurance advisor and where their principal office is located.
Thank you. Ms. Cadoon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'll be very brief. I just want to have a strong support for this law change dealing with residency. We believe this change is very much needed, that it really does need to be updated to reflect kind of modern commerce as well, where the physical presence or location of these advisors, financial institutions is not as important. With all the online activity that now occurs, and also really needed to send that strong signal with the law change that the use of Minnesota businesses is not a factor that will be looked at, so similar to what is currently done with charitable contributions. We think a law change is very much needed, and it cannot be just done through an updated revenue notice. I'd also mention what you said, Senator Score, regarding following more the Northeastern. I am not familiar with all the factors that are used there. But if they do use the location of the professional advisors, their financial institutions, I would recommend that we do not follow that compact. Like I said, that does send that signal that you should not use Minnesota businesses, and that's what we're trying to change. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Are there questions or comments for Ms. Cadoon or again, for Mr. Spizzetto? Oh, Mr. Spizzetto.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to just make an additional comment. We think it's very important to have legislation enacted that really clears this situation up, because it would create an event for us that we could tell our members that, in fact, the legislature has looked at this and acted upon this. So in situations where you're being told by your client that they're being advised by someone in a different state that they need to change their financial advisors, we'd actually have a statutory reference to say, no, that's not the case, and you can continue to seek your services from us. I think that would be very, very important, much more so than a bulletin from the department.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so from what I heard is it's – as we look at Senator Rest's bill, it's more important to make the change with regard to services and residency than being consistent with other states. I mean – I'm seeing heads nod, so that's apparently what the effort would be. But Senator Rest, as you, Madam Chair, have indicated to me, is you make this change, then for the Minnesotans that might actually have benefited from this, that this is gone and
it's
this
gone.
Won't be used.
Just like charitable contributions can no longer be referred to in any way, shape, or form with regard to establishing or not establishing or rebutting a presumption of residency, so too would this factor be eliminated from any discussion.
Madam
Two-edged
Chair.
Sword here. And at some point, somebody might want to bring up that in order to establish residency in Minnesota. With the passage of this one, it would not be, 745 or some variant of it, it would not be allowed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I see that we have
experienced some of the negative consequences when it comes to the financial institutions and the bank accounts. We're seeing that now. But there are other factors that are going to be equally problematic as we continue. For instance, the ownership of other property is one of the factors. The location of a person's union membership is a factor. The location of a place of worship is a factor. Location of business relationships, location of social, fraternal, or athletic organizations. I would like to think the test should be actual presence in the state and not these relationships. And so we might be addressing part of it, but I don't think we're addressing the underlying problem, which is a very intrusive inquiry into people's choices here in the state of Minnesota as opposed to their residency here in the state.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. Thank you very much. Mr. Cummings? Welcome to the division. If you would state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. So last Friday, I spoke to you, Senator Rest, about this bill and about the issue of residency. I know I talked to Senator Ortman yesterday, and we were playing phone tag with Senator Gazelka. So residency is all about where a person is home. Where is the locus of your life? In one of our listening sessions, one participant noted that home is the place where you keep your original wedding photo. In any case, we are interested, this is all about perspectives. And from our perspective, we are interested in what factors are most appropriate in determining the domicile of a resident. So, where did our rule come from? If you look back and where our rule came from, it actually was put together as a series of what we saw in case law many years ago, decades ago. So in our report, we considered whether the standards applied to residency were still meaningful in today's economy as compared to the economy of decades ago. In an effort to update the standards, we stated that the mere physical location of lawyers, CPAs, and banking routing numbers were not a good indicator of your domicile. Yet we believe the best and most straightforward way to deal with that is by a binding revenue notice by the Commissioner of Revenue. As it relates to your bill, Madam Chair, as amended, first of all, we wanted to thank you for authoring the amendment, clarifying that the determination of domicile applies to all domicile determinations and not just if you are domiciled in Minnesota was helpful. We also appreciate the effective date starting at the beginning of a tax year. We believe that those are two positive changes. Madam Chair and members, we would like to work in partnership with the interested groups and Senators Rest and Gazelka to ensure that the definitions of financial institutions and financial advisors are appropriate and well-defined. Right now, we believe that there is some ambiguity. We also want to assure that by excluding the mere physical location of businesses, we are not excluding physical transactions. There are lots of factors that deal with in terms of residency. This is also an issue of fairness for all taxpayers. If taxes are paid in order to pay for services amongst Minnesotans. So ensuring that we have a fair and appropriate standard is important to trying to administer a tax code. We wanted to just also note that by taking this off the table, you're taking this off the table for both the purposes of the taxpayer as well as the purposes of the department. So a taxpayer would not be able to use that as well. I wanted to make also a couple brief comments as it related to your bill, Senator Ortman. Most of them so far have been on Senator Rest's bill. Verifying the days spent primarily in the state primarily for a parent's medical treatment would be almost impossible. Excluding medical days spent in the state would lead to very personal, intrusive questions during an examination process that might make auditing this criteria very difficult without infringing upon other privacy issues. As written in this bill, any taxpayer can file an affidavit to exempt themselves from residency and taxation. And this would not be something, that we cannot audit. As drafted, anyone can file this affidavit, and there is no requirement to meet any standards of residency, including presumably all of us in this room. To prohibit DOR from being able to ascertain the correctness of an affidavit that effectively prohibits income tax collection is equivalent to making our income tax a voluntary contribution. As written, any person can relinquish residency for tax purposes, regardless of intent to change domicile or actual change in life. So we appreciate the continued focus on what are the appropriate ways in which we're looking in terms of what is appropriate for domicile. We appreciate this discussion. We think that the time spent in the past year was helpful in bringing up to be a better resource for this committee. And we'll stand for any questions. I know the Assistant Commissioner for Individual Taxes is also here, and that might be helpful for any questions that may come up.
Are there comments or questions? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I appreciated your call yesterday afternoon, Deputy Commissioner Cummings. But a couple of things in response to your comments. An affidavit would not preclude further audit. An affidavit would not preclude prosecution for fraud. There are ways for the department to act if there are reasons to act to investigate someone that was falsifying their tax returns, just as there currently are. So that's not correct and not a fair reading of the proposed language. And then secondly, I find it hard to imagine that asking about someone's medical treatment is any more intrusive than asking them about the location of their places of worship or about their social, fraternal, or athletic organizations. There are ways for the department to make these inquiries in a respectful and non-intrusive way. But primarily, the goal is to count days and time spent here in Minnesota and not these tangential issues. And we talked on the phone yesterday. There are ways that the department could be helpful with respect to the medical treatment aspect, could allow a primary care physician or a specialist to provide some kind of documentation to the effect that a person were here in the state for medical treatment. So there are ways for the department to assist with this. I hope the department will come to the table and help work through some of these issues. There are significant concerns and questions with the way the department has been conducting its business with respect to these issues.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. Any other comments or questions? Senator Gazelka and then Senator Skoy. Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members and Mr. Cummings. I think, when we look at this whole issue, we have to ask, why is it that people don't want to be Minnesota residents? I mean, that's what we're kind of dancing around. It's people that typically were from Minnesota and now are not, and yet still have ties to Minnesota. And, it is our tax policies and how we have been taxing people that have been more successful and have decided that they want to be out farther. Many of these people may have been to a different state, and in the past it might have been only 3 or 4 months, but they think, well, I'll just stretch it to 6 plus a little bit because I don't want to participate in Minnesota's tax with Minnesota tax policies. And so that's what we're dancing around, and if we don't change our tax policy, then this will continue to happen. But what these bills are doing are recognizing that these folks are going to do whatever it takes to be outside of Minnesota. They're going to do it. And if it means that we say it's going to be 7 months, then it'll be 7 months. But we want to focus on how do we not penalize the rest of the folks here, the small businesses and here medical providers, that if they want to come here and do their medical work, we want them here. We want them to be here. And so that's, as we're working through some of these issues, we just need to acknowledge that if our tax policy doesn't change, they will do whatever it takes to not be part of that. And if we don't change that, then certainly we want to make sure that the folks that benefit in Minnesota are not harmed. And so that's why we're trying to do these bills, and I thank you for trying to work with us. But we're very passionate about that because the folks that stay here, we don't want to penalize.
Madam Chair.
Further comments?
I'm going to pass.
Senator Skoyes passes. Senator Ortman.
Thank you. I appreciate Senator Gazelka's overview of the concerns here. We're talking about income taxes, but we're going to currently, if you look at some of these factors, this ownership of other real property would be a disincentive to have real property here if you were close in that decision-making process about whether you were going to be a residency here or not. We don't want that. We don't want people to divest themselves of Minnesota real property in order to make sure they don't have to pay individual income taxes as a resident of the state, nor do we want them to decide they won't participate in social or athletic organizations or clubs or be charitable givers in those clubs, because that might then lend itself to additional taxation. So we're seeing it from the opposite perspective. You're doing your job saying, let's make sure we have all taxpayers paying, and we're saying, let's make sure that we treat our taxpayers here in Minnesota well and that we don't hurt our own state's economy with these tests. I think there are ways to address these problems. I hope you're willing to work with us on them.
Mr. Cummings.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think one of the things, and I know we talked, this was talked about as people were talking about the Maurer and Larson cases, is that they're really, you know, what was touched on was one statement out of a larger decision, right? One factor among many. If you were to read the cases, the preponderance of that really is dealing with other factors. Now, I know that when we talk to the CPAs and other interested groups, I think as Senator Gazelka was mentioning, they were talking about many of the things that they're hearing about others trying to say, well, come and take a Florida CPA or come and take a Florida lawyer. And then we're also, you know, from the department, we're saying, gosh, in this new economy, people transacting over the phone or over the internet with an attorney or with a CPA, is that really a good determination of where someone is domiciled, right? So I think that over time, I think we're trying to say that, you know, those are aligning in something that we're trying to define, we're trying to work out right now. But we want to make sure that, you know, we're really focused on trying to make sure that we have a standard that is consistent and known, that is appropriate, and that is done in a way that can get the information we need but while not being as intrusive as possible. And I think one of the benefits of what we did over the interim was we really got to listen to a lot of people and their interactions with our process, you know, Senator Ortman, to hear what they're feeling as a person receiving these, or as an attorney or as a CPA assisting others in doing that. So that was helpful as we are sort of thinking how we're interacting with taxpayers.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Cummings. I don't believe there's any further discussion at this time. We thank you for the report. The committee has already acted on the two bills in front of us, so we will move to Senator Miller's bill. Senate file 1211. Senator Miller, welcome to the division. And do you have any amendments for your bill, or is it ready to go as is?
Madam Chair and members, the bill is ready to go as is.
Okay, then you may proceed.
Thank you. And just so members know, and Madam Chair, this bill, Senate file 1211, is a work in progress, and I'm thankful that Mr. Cummins was working the phones yesterday, because I received a phone call from him yesterday afternoon, and we were not aware that the bill was up in committee this morning. That might have been a mistake on our end. So,
but Senator Miller, you did get a chief author notice.
Okay.
Well, everybody got them had a bill up today.
I'm still looking through my email. I haven't seen it yet, Senator Ress. But we, like I said, it was probably a mistake on our end, and for that I do apologize. And I thank you and the committee for being flexible, but I do appreciate the call yesterday. Members, this is an income tax reciprocity bill. Members of the tax committee are fairly up to speed on the work that we've been doing on this, and I appreciate the last biennium working with you, Madam Chair, and Senator Scoy and others.
Senator Miller, I would ask those having a private conversation in the back if they'd move out into the hall. Okay, I think the talkers have left.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
You
may continue.
So this bill is an income tax reciprocity bill with the state of Wisconsin, and we've done some work since the agreement was terminated in 2009. And this proposal in front of us, what we're trying to accomplish is get the agreement back in place that we had prior to the previous agreement being terminated, and tweak a couple things. Members remember, part of the reason why that agreement was terminated by Governor Plenty back in 2009 was the state of Wisconsin was not making timely reimbursement payments back to the state of Minnesota. So what we're trying to accomplish is we're trying to give the Commissioner of Revenue in the state of Minnesota the authority to negotiate a new agreement with the state of Wisconsin and put in place some of those pieces that would allow or ensure that the state of Wisconsin would make timely reimbursement payments. And after speaking with Mr. Cummings yesterday from the Department of Revenue, it sounds like this language, they have some concerns about this. This came over from Chair Davids in the House. I was working on a different proposal, but to make sure that we had the companion bill, this is the language that we're moving forward with. So I am committed to working together with the Department of Revenue to ensure that we're not tying the hands of the commissioner, rather giving the commissioner the authority to negotiate a new agreement with the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Senator Miller. You know, it's my understanding that we're not going to get a very favorable response from the state of Wisconsin because they adopt a reciprocity agreement with us or readopt one that would set a precedent for doing it with the state of Illinois. And in the state of Illinois, Wisconsin would really owe big as opposed to this bill, and not such a huge impact. So that, particularly since their economy is in the doldrums and they have $1 billion or so deficit, that they're maybe unlikely to take this step just for $12 million when it would be such a greater impact and could be used, in a sense, as an argument to do reciprocity with Illinois. What is my recollection of what the situation is correct with regard to Illinois, or has that changed?
Madam Chair and members, I have not heard anything related to the state of Illinois. I have had conversations with members of the Wisconsin legislature, and they were pleased to see that we're moving forward with this language. Of course they are, because under this proposal, the state of Minnesota is picking up the cost for that income tax reciprocity. But none of the conversations that I've had with members from Wisconsin, have they expressed any concern about anything going on with the state of Illinois?
You know, and Senator Miller, I would feel more optimistic about this if the state of Wisconsin had a good track record with making payments, and they don't. They stiffed us, and Governor Plenty was quite correct, in my opinion, of saying we're not going to put up with that. I just think we should be really cautious. It's not that it's not a good policy, because we have it with other states and it works. If you have someone that you're trying to deal with them who have not acted in good faith in the past. Why should we trust them?
Madam Chair, I agree completely, and I do believe that there have been some conversations with the Department of Revenue in Minnesota, with the Department of Revenue in Wisconsin, and although we haven't come together quite on that dollar amount, we did have a benchmark study that was completed, and I thank members of the legislature here in Minnesota for supporting that. So we do have a more accurate number of what the costs would be and how many folks live in Wisconsin and work in Minnesota and vice versa live in Minnesota and work in Wisconsin. This is a huge deal for constituents that live in Minnesota and work in Wisconsin, and the district that I represent, Houston County, one of the smallest counties in the state, is the number one county, most effective county in the state of Minnesota, because the regional center, one of the closest regional centers for them is in La Crosse, Wisconsin. So a lot of the folks that live in Houston County work in Wisconsin. So it's a big deal. But I do believe that the departments have had conversations and there is agreement on the timeliness of those reimbursement payments, from my understanding at least.
And just further, and I think Mr. Cummings might want to comment. Is that true? We can come forward. I might be more interested in it if they would pay their debt and get a clean slate, and then we'll go forward, rather than asking the state of Minnesota to forgive the bad debt from the past in terms of what it was calculated that they owed us prior to 2009, unless I misunderstand how that worked back then. Senator Miller or Mr. Cummings? Senator Miller?
Madam Chair, just to your comment, everything is paid up. I mean, they did eventually pay up. There is no debt outstanding to the best of my knowledge, but okay. I'll let Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Cummings. The debt beats paid up?
At this point, yes, they are. It was broken, and they did make their final payment to the department, I believe, in 11. Wisconsin did not make the final payment until July 12th, 2011.
Okay, Mr. Cummings, did you have any comment on the bill?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Department of Revenue. I spoke to Senator Miller about the bill last night and about the issue of tax filing on Minnesota's eastern border. I do have some comments about the history of reciprocity and some of the background behind it, as well as the bill language itself. Income tax reciprocity allows residents to live in one state but work in another to file their income tax return only in their home state. For over 40 years, tax years 1968 to 2009, Minnesota and Wisconsin had an income tax reciprocity agreement. In 2002, Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura proposed the termination of the agreement because of the negative impact of the timing of the payment on Minnesota revenues and a dispute over the calculation of the payment. The agreement was not terminated, but the Minnesota statute was amended to require that the payment include interest as a condition of retaining the agreement. It really hit a breaking point, Madam Chair, in 2009. At that time, Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty was concerned about the need to wait 15 months for a reciprocity payment to be received. Because of the disagreement of the timing and the amount of payments, Minnesota Commissioner of Revenue Ward Innes terminated the agreement in 2009, effective tax year 2010. As I mentioned, Madam Chair, Wisconsin didn't make the final payment until July of 2011. A 2011 Minnesota law required the Commissioner of Revenue to initiate negotiations with Wisconsin Secretary of Revenue with the objective of entering into a new income tax reciprocity agreement effective beginning in tax year 2012. Negotiations were initiated, but it was determined that there was not enough lead time to finalize an agreement to be in place by January of 12. So negotiations proceeded with the goal of an agreement beginning in tax year 2013, but no agreement was reached. In 2014, the Minnesota legislature authorized Minnesota to enter into a reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin beginning in tax year 2015. The law would allow Wisconsin to pay $1 million less to Minnesota than Wisconsin would have paid had it accepted either of the two previous offers made in 12 or 13. The authorization from this new law applied to agreements only agreed to by September 30th of 14. So in June of 14, in accordance with that law, Commissioner Myron Franz sent the Wisconsin Department of Revenue a proposal aligned with the law passed last session. So that proposal required Wisconsin to pay $91 million, which compensates Minnesota for the 2015 net revenue loss, less $1 million. Later that month, the Wisconsin Department of Revenue Secretary Chandler sent Commissioner Franz a response that restated their previous offers. Commissioner Bowerly and Secretary Chandler have been in communication last month about the possibility of restarting that those talks for next tax year. Madam Chair, I can talk about a little bit about what reciprocity is, or I can go into specific comments about the bill. Which would you prefer,
I think we're
Madam
familiar
Chair?
With the policy. Why don't you just talk about the bill?
Okay, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, we understand in talks with Senator Miller and Representative David, we understand that the bill is a work in progress. We look forward to working with Senator Miller, Representative David's in the committee if this bill moves closer to coming together by the end of session in order to move us closer to a reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin. This bill requires an agreement rather than authorizing the commissioner to enter in one. While this bill requires the commissioner to enter into an agreement with Wisconsin, it does not specify the other requirements other than the meaning of net loss. There are a number of other crucial conditions that would need to be negotiated. Madam Chair, you already mentioned the timing of the payments. As you know, I read in a newspaper last month where the Wisconsin skipped a $100 million payment to a creditor. I'm not sure if that will be made at a later date, but that's something that we are thinking about and considering. The use of benchmark year data and any adjustments for changes in Minnesota and Wisconsin tax rates since the last benchmark study. These are, we would like to have a benchmark study every 5 years in order to make sure that that is being done. And then any annual adjustments. These items would really need to be negotiated in order to have a strong, mutually beneficial agreement. But under the bill, the commissioner would have little negotiating power if the agreement is mandatory. And as you mentioned, Madam Chair, the difference between the Minnesota methodology and the Wisconsin methodology is $5 or $6 million per year. But another thing to consider there is that a very large payment that Wisconsin would have to make, which is about $100 million per year. And that would be something that I know that you mentioned, Madam Chair. This bill set the payment at what Wisconsin wants it to be. This would result in ongoing revenue losses. And without the benefit of a benchmark study, those ongoing revenue losses could increase over time. And then finally, the bill is retroactive to the beginning of the year. This effective date would make reciprocity apply in tax year 15. Because we had no agreement at the start of the year, Wisconsin residents working in Minnesota have had tax withheld by Minnesota. And Minnesota residents working in Wisconsin have had tax withheld in Wisconsin. In order to make reciprocity work well, all parts of the agreement would need to be settled by October 1st of the preceding year. So, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be a resource. I thank Senator Miller for his ongoing partnership with the department as this issue is talked about. And we look forward to the conversation on this bill and other bills this session.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Any comments for Senator Miller? Further comments for Senator Miller or Mr. Cummings? Seeing none, Senator Skoy moves that Senate File 1211 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Miller. There being no further business, the schedule for this week, Senator Skoy, Tuesday and Thursday in the full committee.
Tuesday and Thursday.
And then the division will meet on Wednesday. We're adjourned.